There are nearly 20 million college students in the United States. 40% will stop going to church during college. 50% will never return. The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod is seeking to meet this challenge through LCMSU. Why? Because 100% of college students matter to God and to His church. College is tough. You need Jesus. We'll help. LCMSU. Check us out at lcms.org/lcmsu.
What you and I think of when we think of history would have made no sense to the gospel writers. The purpose of the gospels was not to reveal specific facts about Jesus. It was to reveal truths about Jesus that the gospel writers already believed. Now, what that means is that the gospel is filled with both historical and mystical information, and the job of the modern biblical scholar is to figure out which is which. And that's a process that's been underway for almost 200 years now, actually, in biblical studies.
It's an excerpt from our recent interview with Reza Aslan, author of a number one New York Times bestseller, Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus. He contends there, and he hangs an awful lot of his assertions about who Jesus really was and his assertions about how the Gospels are largely mythical on this contention that he repeated several times in the course of our conversation with him a couple weeks ago, saying that the ancients had no concept of history as we do today. It's a recent idea, this idea of history. They didn't think that way. They thought in mythical terms, in terms of truth, not history or fact. Is that true? Welcome back to Issues Etc., coming to you from the studios of Lutheran Public Radio in Collinsville, Illinois. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Dr. Paul Meyer joins us. We're going to be spending some time getting an historian's response to Reza Aslan and his contentions made on the air here on Issues Etc. and in his book, Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth. A little bit later, Pastor Ted Giese joins us. We'll be reviewing a movie that's coming out here called Nebraska. Our call-in number, 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-MY-IE. Send us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org, or a tweet at issuesetc. Dr. Paul Meyer is a regular guest professor emeritus of ancient history at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo, author of numerous books, including In the Fullness of Time, an historian looks at Christmas, Easter, and the early church, and his latest publication, The Constantine Codex. Dr. Meyer, welcome back.
Good to be with you, Todd.
How do you respond? You have devoted your entire long career to the study of ancient history. You are an historian. How do you respond to Reza Aslan's contention that the ancients had no concept of history as we do today?
Well, it's a foolish statement to begin with, Todd, because the ancients invented the science of history, just for openers. It comes from a Greek term, historia, and some of the finest historians ever to come across were Greek historians. For example, we have the father of history himself, of course, is Herodotus. And he, again, does a pretty faithful job of reporting what happened during the Persian Wars. And people rely on him to the present day yet for information there. And one of the finest modern historians was Thucydides, who's not modern at all. He wrote 400 B.C. on the great Peloponnesian War, saying that he wanted to do as objective a job as possible in delivering truth. And by the way, I don't know how Reza Aslan uses the term truth. He implies that that's the true myth or something like that. No, historians are after truth. Luke is the same way when he talks about he studied all things carefully, and now he wanted to write a very orderly and true account, having interviewed resources. Look, you're going to find historians that have bias, of course. There's no question about it. Ancient, medieval, modern historians will often have bias, but you know how to adjust for those biases when you're trying to figure out what actually happened. And the whole idea of history, ancient, medieval, or modern, is simply to find out what really happened at the time. And then for somebody to come along and say, well, the ancients didn't really look for facts in history is just foolishness.
So, I mean, suffice it to say that if Reza Aslan were correct on that point, you would not have had much to do in the last 50 years, would you have? You wouldn't have had a lot of history to study.
Well, that's right, yeah. I mean, this is just ridiculous. Here we have, I guess, a Muslim coming across in a Christian area and doing a put-down in the life of Jesus. I guess what gets me furious is why the Western press is so intrigued by this and why they gave him so much publicity. It shows you how open we are, but just consider the reverse. What if the converse took place? What if a Christian historian were, again, doing a put-down in the life of Islam in an Islamic country? You know, don't sell him an insurance policy if you're the insurance company. He wouldn't get out of there alive. So I don't like the uneven playing field that we're dealing with today.
On the theme of history, Reza Aslan also asserted in our recent interview with him that the event of the resurrection of Jesus Christ is no business of historians.
When it comes to the resurrection, that's a tricky subject for the historian. I write in my book that, by definition, the resurrection is an ahistorical event, and so therefore historians have no business commenting upon it. But what is a historical fact is the claim to the resurrection. So let me just be clear one more time. The historian cannot talk about whether the resurrection, quote-unquote, happened or not, because that's a matter of faith. It's outside the bounds of history. What we can talk about is the undeniable fact that very soon after Jesus' death, within 2 or 3 or 4 years, the belief in his resurrection had already become firmly embedded in the doctrine of this movement.
What in the world is he saying, Dr. Meyer?
It's a little bit difficult, isn't it? First of all, if something happened or did not happen in the past, this is the job of historical inquiry. To say it's apart from history is just ridiculous. In other words, you may not like Napoleon, and therefore, well, let's eliminate any reference to him, pro or con. This is ridiculous. Indeed, the historian is perfectly qualified to talk about whether or not something happened at a given time. That's the job of the historian in the first place. And then to say it's ahistorical, what he is correct on is saying that, you bet, the concept of Jesus rising from the dead was indeed very early embedded in the Christian message. That part is true. In fact, you and I know that was part of what we call the kerygma, the gospel proclamation. The earliest message of the church, the earliest sermons of Paul of Tarsus were, Jesus of Nazareth is the fulfillment of Old Testament prophecy, and he rose from the dead. And now let's begin with that one. I just love to debate Aslan at this point and say, how do we explain that this became embedded? And that now, Christians, of course, would answer, duh, because it happened. That's why. We have an easy job answering that question. Now, those who doubt the resurrection have a very difficult job in their hands. How do they explain it? Oh, yeah, you hear dozens of different estimations as to how this thing could have happened. Mainly, they all revolve around Peter. They say that Peter, again, got the disciples together after Jesus did not rise from the dead. And he says, look, fellas, we got to do something else now. We wasted 3 years hitching our wagon to the wrong star. What do you want to do, go back to fishing? And, of course, the disciples' faces light up, and they say, yeah, that's a good idea. And then Peter suddenly says, hold it. I've got an idea. Follow this plan, and someday they'll name churches after us, okay? Something like that. And then he hatches this idea of the resurrection, and that, then they run with that. I mean, this is really pathetic. I'm trying to say this could not possibly have happened, but even using Reza Aslan's kind of logic that the supernatural is impossible, it's beyond the bounds of history, this is the way they explain it. And I think Christians ought to be more ready to defend the faith at that point and challenge the unbelieving world, saying, how do you suppose that that became part of the earliest Christian preaching? And then, of course, I bring out in my works the fact that the empty tomb is really part of provable history. Again, I can't categorically prove the resurrection to you, but I can tell you this, the other main hallmark of the resurrection has to be a body no longer there. And that we can prove. And I do that twice in my, well, two chapters in my book, In the Fullness of Time, a historian looking at Christmas, Easter, and the early church. And again, I'm surprised that, you know, Reza Aslan himself, you know, wants to undertake this. He is a Muslim, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
He was born a Muslim, converted to Christianity, then back to Islam after taking a religious studies course.
Boy, as I tell you, his eternal prospects are not very good doing that. That's so sad. That's so sad. I would love to talk to this guy, maybe not to win any debating points, but to see what it is when you compare the claims of Muhammad and Islam that are so undocumented compared to the beautiful historical correlations between the secular and sacred evidence that we find in Christianity. There's no contest. The one is almost 95% provable from the facts of the ancient world, and the other is not. There's no way you can draw parallels or even check out any points of tangency or build any bridges between the evidence in the Holy Quran and the Holy Bible. The Holy Bible, you can build bridges all over the place, and that's what I've been doing for the last 40 years, is kind of being a bridge builder to show you how many of these facts claimed in Scripture are also mentioned in totally outside secular sources. Can't do that with the Quran.
Dr. Paul Meyer is our guest. We'll have some time with him on the other side of this break, getting an historian's response to our interview with Reza Aslan, author of a number one New York Times bestseller, Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth. Dr. Paul Meyer is professor emeritus of ancient history at Western Michigan University.
The Church's Music from the 20th Century. The 17th Century. The 11th Century. The 8th century. The 4th century. The best of the Church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, etc.
The 500th anniversary of the Lutheran Reformation is fast approaching. We have such a rich history as Lutherans, and many people don't realize that. The CLCC offers a seminar called Your Reformation Walk that teaches that rich heritage and helps you appreciate it. The CLCC also offers other seminars designed to help laity learn to appreciate what Lutherans believe, teach, and confess. So invite us to your church. Visit theclcc.org and get details on scheduling a seminar for your church today.
Did you know that we send out an email each week that details upcoming show topics? It's available for you to include in your weekly church bulletin. Just click the Issues, Etc. Journal logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org, and sign up to receive the church bulletin blurb. It's an easy way to invite your fellow parishioners to listen to Issues, Etc. issuesetc.org. Look for the Issues, Etc. Journal logo and register to receive a weekly bulletin paragraph from Issues, Etc.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues, Etc. It's Tuesday afternoon, January the 21st. We're coming to you live. We're talking with Dr. Paul Meyer, Professor Emeritus of Ancient History at Western Michigan University and author of numerous books, including In the Fullness of Time, An Historian Looks at Christmas, Easter, and the Early Church, and his latest is called The Constantine Codex. Let's go back to hear some of what Reza Aslan said in our recent interview with him. I know that this probably I don't want to raise your blood pressure on this, but this is what Raisa Aslan thinks is a really good example of how the gospel writers rewrote Jesus' story.
The story of Jesus' birth in Bethlehem. The Gospel of Luke says that there is a census in the year 6 AD of the entire Roman world, that Jesus is, like every subject of Rome, forced to uproot himself from the, or Jesus' parents, I should say, like every Roman subject is forced to uproot himself from his home in Nazareth and travel to Bethlehem, the place of his father's birth, in order to be counted, and that's why he's born in Bethlehem. And that's just simply incorrect. There, first of all, there was a census in 6 AD, but it wasn't of the entire Roman world. It was just of Judea, Idumea, and Perea. So it didn't even count Galilee, which is where Jesus lived, so it wouldn't have affected him in the slightest. And secondly, we know for a fact that Roman law did not require people, the subject citizens, to uproot themselves from the place where they lived and where their property was, which is the whole point of being counted, is to count your property, and travel great distances to the place of your father. That just simply did not happen. Here's the important thing that I want to make. The point that I want to make is that Luke knew that that story was factually incorrect. He was still a Roman citizen living under Roman law. His readers knew that that story is factually incorrect. They were Roman citizens living under Roman law. They didn't care, because they understood that what they were reading was an issue that involved truth, not fact. The facts didn't matter.
Your response, Dr. Meyer?
What kind of crazy idea does he have in terms of the term truth? I mean, in other words, a truth is it's Orwellian. A truth is falsehood, is what he's saying. I mean, this is ridiculous. First of all, he does pick on the one disputed point in the entire gospel record where there does seem to be some disjuncture between what Luke claims in his gospel and the facts on the outside. But that has been discussed by theologians now for several centuries, and there are several absolutely grammatically defensible translations, which could mean, and again, this was the census taken before that famous one taken by Quirinius, and it could also mean this census was first completed under Quirinius, is what Luke could be saying there very easily. What, 10 years to take a census? You bet! It took the Romans 40 years to get a complete census from Gaul, which is today called France. And for him to attack one of the finest historians of antiquity, Luke, who has his details so beautifully correct, he knows he's going to have Gentile readers, who not Jewish readers, who may be used to myth. No, he has a Gentile readership in mind who know the facts. So he would not intentionally, I guess what bothers me is the statement that he intentionally lied here, knowing that he was not doing the facts. I would someday hope that Luke and Reza Aslan could somehow get together and Luke could give him a knuckle sandwich. I mean, this is just ridiculous. Indeed, Luke is the one who gives us absolutely honest titles for the Roman officials. For example, most would say Gallio was the governor of Greece. No, Luke says he was the proconsul of Achaia, which is the Roman renaming of Greece, and it's exactly the role that Gallio had, according to Roman records. He's very accurate in this respect. Luke's an eyewitness of Paul's journeys. Lucius Sergius Paulus, for example, on the island of Cyprus, who hears Paul and is converted by him. We got his statue in the Roman Forum. It's the actual name exactly recorded by Luke. He's the one who gives us his tremendously accurate place-by-place information, word-by-word response. And so for him to attack Luke as a myth-maker is just ridiculous.
It's a little compounded in that case, isn't it, Dr. Meyer, in that he's not only asserting that Luke lied, but that Luke kind of doubly lied. He distorted the facts, and then he explicitly presented those facts as though they were an accurate and orderly account.
Yeah, it's absolutely correct. Your interpretation there is just a double put down in terms of anything true. I'd really, does Reza Aslan want to ask Pilate's question, what is truth? truth is something I can manipulate to win an argument against the Christians. That seems to be something of Reza Aslan's whole approach. And by the way, how can he name his book Zealot when Jesus is the Prince of Peace who is constantly saying, turn your cheek, love your enemies? Does that sound like a zealot to you? This is ridiculous. And this whole idea of zealotry in terms of Jesus' mission really went out 50 years ago. S.G.F. Brandon in England provided books called Jesus the Revolutionary, and he tried to make Jesus a zealot. Why? The only shred of evidence that any of these zealot people had was that one of Jesus' disciples was called James the Zealot. Yes. Does that mean that James the Zealot continued his zealotry when he became a follower of Jesus? I don't think so. And in the Garden of Gethsemane, when Jesus tells Peter, take that sword that you just used to hack off the servant of the high priest's ear and put it back in its sheath, this is Jesus' no to zealotry. So how dare this guy come along and try to totally transpose Jesus' ministry in that fashion? He lies through his teeth in terms of the title of his book.
Another point that I wanted to raise with him in the course of our conversation was why he didn't treat the New Testament Gospels like he would other ancient historical sources. Here's his response.
We do, as a matter of fact. So I'll give you one example. Concurrent with the writing of the Gospels is the work of a great Jewish historian and Roman citizen by the name of Flavius Josephus. Josephus, in the end of the first century, wrote a massive history of the Jews and then a second history of the Jewish war that ultimately resulted in the destruction of Jerusalem in the year 70. Now, Josephus is not writing about gods or messiahs. He's not a theologian. He's not making, faith statements at all. He's trying as hard as possible to just simply tell an accurate story. He calls himself a historian. But even so, we know that a lot of the claims that Josephus makes do not actually match what we know about the history of the time. And we realize that, of course, Josephus is writing his history for the Emperor Titus, the man who actually destroyed Jerusalem. So, for instance, we know that Titus and his troops deliberately burned Jerusalem to the ground, deliberately razed the temple in Jerusalem as punishment for the Jewish revolt. Josephus says, oh no, it was an accident, and Titus did everything in his power to try to put out the fire, it was not his fault that the city and the temple of God burned to the ground. Well, obviously that's not true. I mean, obviously he is saying that because he wants to ingratiate himself to his benefactor.
You've done no small amount of study of Josephus, Dr. Meyer. How do you respond to everything that Aslan had to say there?
Well, I'm not going to say that Josephus does not make errors. I'm not going to say that he has no bias. There's no question that Josephus did know on which side his bread was buttered and who did the buttering. And so he's somewhat more pro-Roman in his writing of the Jewish war than the Jewish antiquities. But please understand, the guy, again, is, put it this way, he knows how to make lemonade out of a lemon situation. I mean, he was ready to be killed before Vespasian, and so he then fights for time and then has a chance to do certainly a good job in terms of the historicity of the time. There's no question about it, because he knows there are all kinds of Romans and Jews who could criticize his writings if he were telling a falsehood. Now, there's no question that it is possible indeed that Titus did not want to see the temple burned. We know that Titus preserved other things in the city of Jerusalem. For example, one great tower in Herod the Great's palace at the western end of the city, the Tower Phasael, was intentionally preserved by the winning of General Titus as a model for the future, so that future ages could see how tough it was to conquer the city of Jerusalem. And he could have done the same thing with the temple. He may have had this in mind, hey, here's this beautiful temple. This is the people that I conquered, This is what's left of it. There's no services taking place now inside that temple. So he might have had this idea of saving the temple. And now why must he say that's obviously untrue? It's not obvious at all.
Dr. Paul Meyer is our guest. We'll take a break, and when we come back with him, we'll continue for a few more minutes getting his historical response to our interview with Reza Aslan, author of the number one New York Times bestseller, Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth. I invite your questions and your comments, 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-MYIE, or send us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org. Dr. Paul Meyer is Professor Emeritus of Ancient History at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo, author of numerous books, including In the Fullness of Time, An Historian Looks at Christmas, Easter, and the Early Church, and his latest publication, The Constantine Codex. You can purchase these books at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. When we come back, we're going to hear Reza Aslan talk about how Jesus thought of his own ministry. He's actually going to make some claims about the course of Jesus' ministry as pertains to what Reza Aslan asserts to be his primary identity as a Jewish zealot, namely that Jesus spent the better part of his ministry avoiding the city of Jerusalem and then finally headed there with a death wish. We'll be right back.
Noted author and history professor Dr. Paul Meyer on the uniqueness of Issues Etc.
I'm delighted not only to listen to Issues Etc., but also to have the privilege of being on the program from time to time. Issues is never afraid to take a stand on the thorny, vexing issues that clutter our daily horizons. And it does so in the name of a solidly based Christianity that doesn't flirt with fads or fantasies. Whereas some Christian programs sidestep ethical and doctrinal questions in our day, Issues takes them head-on in a fearless, responsible, thoughtful manner. Both head and heart are involved when Issues applies Holy Scripture.
You can support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by making a tax-deductible gift today. Donate online at issuesetc.org, or you can donate by check. Lutheran Public Radio, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Thanks for your support.
Do you have a student finishing up 8th grade at a Lutheran school? Do you wish there were a Lutheran high school close to where you live so your student could continue going to a Lutheran school? What if there was an opportunity for high school students in public or Lutheran school to take classes like Latin, logic, and hard-hitting theology courses? Well, there is. It's called Wittenberg Academy, the first completely online classical Lutheran high school. Visit our website, wittenbergacademy.org, to find out more.
Does your church need a backup organist? The Virtual Organist Service from Church Music Solutions is the next best thing to an on-site organist. Send us your musical choices, including liturgy and hymns. We'll assemble your service and send it to an iPad that controls your church's organ on Sunday. The result is genuine organ leadership on your instrument with your selections when you need it. See our videos on YouTube or visit our website at churchmusicsolutions.com.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers, you're listening to Issues, etc.
We Lutherans were never aided by following along with some other tradition's theological priorities and catchphrases.
Issues Etc. regular guest, Pastor Heath Curtis, Coordinator for Stewardship for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod on a Lutheran approach to stewardship.
Other folks are not approaching it from our good, solid Lutheran understanding of law and gospel and vocation. There's a place to talk about this in Christianity, and we have a way of talking about stewardship as Lutherans without ever using the word stewardship, if you like. I'm going to talk to you today about your vocation in your home, in your church, in your society, and how each one of these makes a claim on you, on your presence, on your support, on your prayers. That's how we should talk about this as Lutherans.
You'll find several stewardship resources at lcms.org/stewardship, lcms.org/stewardship.
South Africa.
China.
Germany.
Trinidad and Tobago.
Did you know that people listen to Issues Etc. around the world?
India.
Sweden.
Egypt.
France.
Turkey.
Japan.
Australia.
Canada.
United Kingdom,
Hong Kong,
Austria,
Finland,
Malaysia,
Singapore,
Bulgaria,
Korea,
Brazil.
You can support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by making a secure online donation at issuesetc.org. You can also donate by check. Make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio and send it to LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Help us proclaim Christ to the world.
The Philippines,
Mexico,
Spain,
New Zealand,
Kuwait.
The Epiphany Hymn, O Morning Star, How Fair and Bright, playing right now at our 24/7 sacred music station, LutheranPublicRadio.org. And that's how you find it. Just go on the web, LutheranPublicRadio.org, and you'll find 24/7 sacred music following the course of the church year. It's absolutely free. And as Epiphany rolls on, you'll hear that Epiphany music. And with the coming of the season of Lent, LutheranPublicRadio.org will feature more and more Lenten music headed on toward Easter. Following the course of the church year, LutheranPublicRadio.org. We're getting an historian's response to our interview with Raisa Aslan, author of Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth. Dr. Paul Meyer is our guest. Dr. Meyer, this last thing that Raisa Aslan brought up with regard to how Jesus thinks of his own ministry ties in closely to his thesis that you mentioned before the break, that Jesus was really nothing more than a first century, one among many first century Jewish zealots intent upon the overthrow of the Roman oppressors.
Here's how I would answer that question as a historian. 99% of that ministry, indeed every minute of his ministry except for the last few days of it, was spent not just in Galilee, but in the backwoods of Galilee, in the small towns, the small villages. He assiduously avoided big cities, and he absolutely avoided Judea, and almost treated Jerusalem like it was, you know, the plague. I mean, he stayed as far from Jerusalem as he possibly could. And then one day, out of the blue, for reasons that we can only guess, he says to his disciples, "Let's go to Jerusalem." And not only does he say, "Let's go to Jerusalem," but he decides to enter Jerusalem in about the most provocative way possible. You know, he declares himself king in that triumphal entry into Jerusalem when he's riding on a donkey, the way that the prophet Zechariah says that the king shall enter Jerusalem. He takes part in this dramatically violent act in the temple, which would have been instantly punishable by death. In other words, it's almost as though he is courting his own death. It's almost as though he is deliberately trying to get the attention of the authorities who more or less have ignored him up to this point.
How do you respond to the particular claims made there by Raisa Aslan to support his idea that Jesus was nothing more of one among many Jewish zealots?
Well, of course, as of so much of this, it's totally framed by a terrible bias in advance that says that there's nothing true in the Gospels. And so then why does he believe Jesus even went to Jerusalem, for that matter? I mean, clearly, we have history here that's being mistreated by Aslan, left, right, up, and down. No question about that. It is true that Jesus often appears as the rural redeemer, but he's also the savior of the city. There's more and more evidence that his youth was spent up in Nazareth, which is a suburb of the city of Sepphoris, which was a capital of Galilee. He also came to Jerusalem frequently, not only the 12-year-old Jesus in the temple, but also the three Passovers that are mentioned in the Gospels. Obviously, he was a faithful Jew who wanted to do his thing at the temple, and he did regularly. So what is wrong then with the claim that he was only in Galilee? That's not true at all. It's true that he did have Capernaum as his hometown, and there's a reason for it, by the way, even from a human vantage point. It's a lovely place. It's on the Sea of Galilee. It's a wonderful center for his ministry. But again, three times at least, he comes down to Jerusalem, and also for the final 7 days of his earthly life before the resurrection. Now, there may be some truth to it, not that Jesus had a death wish, but he has certainly the idea of God's plan of salvation, which he must fulfill. He knew the inevitability of it. And so, sure, he's finally saying, now the time has come for me to fulfill God's plan of salvation and to make sure that this is properly registered. He wanted the people to know. So he comes in on Palm Sunday on the back of a donkey. Fine, that's a humble act. That's also a royal act in terms of Zechariah the prophet. Good in both cases. He does attract attention for his teaching every day during Holy Week. He was teaching in the temple. And obviously, after the resurrection, he's going to continue inspiring his people from that point on. So I don't know what his point is, Reza Aslan's point here, other than, again, to try to discredit Jesus and make him some sort of zealot. Now, quite frankly, this overthrowing the tables of the money changers in the temple is about the only, even semi-violent act we have Jesus doing. When the rest of his ministry is to love your enemies and to be the Prince of Peace indeed in human form, how then to turn him into a zealot because at one point he uses a little bit of violence to understand to get his message understood? Come on, this is ridiculous.
So this, finally, with only about a minute here, Dr. Meyer, this picture that Aslan paints of Jesus is one that has to be done by consciously and intentionally ignoring the most ancient accounts, eyewitness accounts that we have of Jesus' life. Is that how you do history?
Not how you do history at all. No question about that. Here we have a person who begins with the bias. First of all, you can't do miracles. The supernatural's out. Therefore, any place where the supernatural is supposed to have taken place is ruined right there. Secondly, your bias is that this cannot be the Son of God. Therefore, you reduce his mission to what? Well, what's left? Okay, let's see. Oh, yeah, he was pretty violent that Monday, house cleaning the temple, and now he's a zealot. So what they do is they demolish the historical image of Jesus, then they've got to substitute something there for that vacuum, and so then they substitute what? Well, just play the Jesus game, and that is do whatever caricature of Jesus you want. He chose the zealot option. Others have chosen the wisecracking savant option, like John Dominic Crossan did when he pictures Jesus as something of a person who's kind of a skeptic against the government, telling jokes against the government. Others want to get Jesus married off, Jesus the happy husband. And who, of course, is always Mrs. Jesus? That would be Mary Magdalene. Again, Dan Brown wasn't the first. There have been many who tried to get Jesus married off. And so Jesus the magician was the image done again by the professor of Old Testament at Columbia University in New York until it was proven an outright forgery. And so there are always these latter-day sensationalist authors trying to recreate God in Christ in their own image, doing God the favor he created man in his own image, so now man feels he has to recreate God by some caricature of his son Jesus Christ. I'm sick and tired of it. I hope most Christians are sick and tired of it. I wish they would respond more vocally, as Issues Etc. does in this respect.
Dr. Paul Meyer is Professor Emeritus of Ancient History at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo, author of numerous books, including In the Fullness of Time, An Historian Looks at Christmas, Easter, and the Early Church, and his latest is The Constantine Codex. Dr. Meyer, thank you so much for your time.
You too. Good to be with you, Todd.